Okay, thanks for having me. This is my first ANICAPA meeting, and I'm very happy to be here. I'm very impressed with all your questions and everything, so much so that, you know, I stuck a lot into this talk, so we'll see how much we can get through. Okay, so I'm going to start off a little bit slow, just to sort of introduce things, and then I'll talk a little bit about the three subjects I want to get to. But first, let me just sort of mention why gravity. Gravity's pretty weak, but on astrophysical and cosmological scales, it's significant. And that's kind of always been my interest. One could argue that gravity is more fundamental than a lot of other physics and when I say gravity, I'm talking about general relativity, right? So the rest of physics kind of assumes you have x, y, z, and t, or some kind of space-time. And then for me, I've always been interested in black holes. Right? There's the famous quote about the most perfect macroscopic objects. You guys know who said that? No one? Chandrasekhar? So, I mean, in some sense, black holes are kind of the simplest things. In a lot of numerical relativity talks, one sort of talks about kind of the history of things. And what was called the Holy Grail for a while was to be able to evolve two black holes, the two-body problem. Now that's kind of passé. It's kind of simple. But as I've continued in my research, one thing that's kind of impressed me about gravity is that it's sort of, within itself, it's multidisciplinary. Mathematicians are interested in it, astrophysicists are interested in it, and of course, you know, physicists in general are interested in it. And I put on here, just because I knew I would forget, that it's been 100 years since the advent of general relativity. Okay, it's kind of hard to forget because every kind of newsletter or email I get announces yet another conference or meeting about 100 years of GR. So you pick a country and you can find a conference there celebrating this 100 years. So no one argued with me about gravity being more fundamental. But you could sort of argue it's less fundamental. I'm excited about some of these ideas that gravity is an emergent force. That's not my research or anything, but I think it's pretty neat. Okay, so what I do is numerical relativity, which some people in the field hate this name. But it's a name nevertheless, so I wanted to mention it. Why do people hate it? Well, one, because, you know, numerical sort of says it's something other than, like, real physics. But of course it is. So, you know, basically I try and call myself a relativist, but I study it numerically. In part because it's hard. And in part because once you start doing astrophysics with it, it's very, very messy. And basically, because of both of these, we do it on supercomputers. I'm very interested in some of this high-performance computing. I'm not going to talk about it in this talk. I wanted to give you a picture of a cluster. And you go on Google Images, and there are lots of pictures of clusters. But I felt like I owed it to you to give you a picture of a cluster that I use. And so this is Stampede. This is in Austin. It's part of the Exceed thing, for which I had a logo at the beginning. This is probably just one wall. I've never actually seen this machine. I actually went to school in Austin, but this was long before then. The machine before this was called Ranger. And I mean, I don't know if you guys have been in rooms with clusters before, but you hear fans going. It is so loud in there that instead of fire alarms, they have the red lights flashing, because you wouldn't be able to hear an alarm. There's one interesting story I guess I should mention one. Once I upgraded my cluster, so I run a little cluster, right? So this is a wall of racks. So just picture one rack. That's what my cluster looks like. So I upgraded it, and I keep it with IT on campus. And so I put the nodes in there, plug them in, turn them on, everything's fine. Walk back to my office. I'm like, oh, great, now I can run bigger jobs. I run it. I get a call in 10 minutes. All their machines were down because it pulled so much current, just not from turning them on, but from running on them. And to me, that was just it's so visceral, so real. Okay, so what this talk is, and so I haven't gotten to any physics yet. It's not a LIGO talk. Do you guys know about LIGO? Okay, well, so I'm not going to talk much about LIGO, but LIGO is a big motivating factor. So it's a gravitational wave observatory. I just said I wasn't going to talk about it, but let me just... It's a gravitational wave observatory that is going to detect things this year, next year. Don't ask me how. I mean, I know sort of how, but it boggles the mind that they can do this.
In the next year or two?
Pretty confident. Pretty confident. It's sort of like the confidence you get when you jump out of a plane with a parachute. It's like you hope it you have to have confidence, because otherwise the other thing is just so you can't even contemplate. Okay, it's not a summary talk. I'm not going to teach you about numerical relativity. I sort of feel a little bit bad about that, but to me that's not the exciting stuff. I want to get to physics. Okay, what this talk is. So what I wanted to do, I vacillated, I've kind of went back and forth all over the place, but what I wanted to do was talk about sort of the most exciting stuff. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a little sampling. Okay, so this, if... Exactly. So three things. So if I were in the audience, this would be tailor-made for me, because this is about my attention span. Okay. So the first, is anti-de Sitter space stable against black hole formation? There's a lot of physics in that. If you don't quite know what ADS is, anti-de Sitter space, I'll say just a tiny little bit. Okay, there's a lot I'm not going to say, right? I mean, if you're trying to, each of these deserves a talk in itself. This is a question, I'll just mention a couple things, that mathematicians are interested in, string theorists are interested in, so it's sort of multidisciplinary. It's really neat, there's a lot of physics. It's stuff I've had some, I was going to say undergrads, but also a high school student work on. And I guess I should also say these topics are arranged in time. A little bit. When I talk about this, I'll mention a paper from 1955. And when I talk about this next one, I'll mention a paper from 1977. So the next one, how does a black hole interact with a magnetic field to produce an astrophysical... There's a lot of physics there as well. Okay. And by the way, I'm assuming we're all comfortable with black holes. And the last is the thing I've worked on most recently. So what I do for LIGO is look at the merger of compact objects, black holes, neutron stars. These things are what's called gravitationally loud. They're just going to produce tons of gravitational wave energy. Just incredible amounts. And so it's the most likely thing we're gonna see. And so I just picked out one little thing, which is, can we tell what the equation of state is for neutron star matter? So this is just, this spans from subnuclear to super, so past nuclear densities, things we can't create in the lab. So much so that the INT at UW, they're very interested in this. Okay, they had a thing a couple summers ago I was at. Okay. I didn't quite know where to put this, but I wanted to question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just want to make sure that I get to hear about the equation of state, because I've often told students a neutron star is like a big neutron, just all packed together. And I know I'm wrong, so will you tell me how wrong I am? Or does nobody really know?
I know that you're wrong. Some people know in much more detail why and how you're wrong. But one quickly reaches the point, no one knows anything. Yeah, so I should say that I come at this right from relativity. And it's the astrophysicists, the people that come, that really are going to be able to give you an hour-long talk on how wrong you are. Okay. So one thing, so we're all at undergraduate institutions. A lot of this work involves collaborators. I was on sabbatical a couple years ago at the Perimeter Institute. And Alex Buchel is a string theorist, came up to me and said, hey, you know, can we look at this? And I said, oh yeah, we can do that. And it's just led into, you'll see, just a lot of work that we've done. The second two things are computationally much more significant. And it kind of all arose when me and Louise Lehner, who's now at Perimeter, applied for this huge grant from the NSF. Just sort of pie in the sky application. And it turns out that we were at the KITP, well back then it was the ITP, when the program officer for the NSF, who was also at that program, mentioned we'd be getting the money. Okay, and so that was 2004, I think. And so all of this, well not all of this, but the latter two projects kind of arose from that. Okay. So any questions before we dive into these three things? I'm going to try and pause after each one. Okay. Minkowski space. It's not ADS. Minkowski space is flat. What we want to do is consider what its stability properties are. So we have to perturb it. You can perturb it lots of different ways. One of the easiest is to introduce a scalar field, phi. So it's just energy at any given point, it's a scalar, simplest thing in the world. It follows the Klein-Gordon equation. This may not look nonlinear, but it is nonlinear. It's nonlinear because it has a dynamic metric. Christodoulou and Kleinerman, very famous mathematicians, were able to show rigorously that Minkowski space is stable. If you make it small enough, if you introduce a small amount of energy, that energy will just do whatever it wants and just go outward. Nothing happens. It's stable, but you can always introduce a larger perturbation and see if you make a black hole. So let me switch. Okay, so I'm going to show you a movie. I'm going to show you a movie, but I've got to tell you a little bit about how this works. This is the radius. So we're working in spherical symmetry. So computationally, it's a one spatial dimensional problem. This is the origin. We're going to just start with some energy. So it's going to look like, I guess, a Gaussian pulse right here. So to interpret that in 3D, you spin that around in all directions. So you have a shell of energy that represents a perturbation to Minkowski space. This yellow is what we call small, the blue is what we call large. And we're going to evolve it. The bounds here, this is 0, and it goes up to 1. And what we're plotting is 2m over r. Right? And so if you remember the Schwarzschild metric, 2m over r, so if that goes to 1, you get a black hole. So let me see. Okay, so here's roughly the beginning. I think I've got that right. So again, this is the small, this is the large. So basically you can think of this as how much energy there is. Okay, and it's going to evolve inward. We're basically sending it in. Okay, you can sort of imagine like some sphere of flashlights. I mean, light is more complicated than scalar energy, but something like that. And so we can evolve this. And the blue goes up, and the yellow goes out. Okay. But we can tune this. So we can start with something right in between. And what's that going to do? Can anyone tell me? No? Right, so there's a lot of varieties here, but there's no way for it to stop. It can't form any kind of star or static solution. It has to keep moving. And no one can tell me what it's going to do unless you evolve it. Simple as that. Sorry. So here we have a bunch of them. So I've tuned this, right? So we still have yellow and blue, but I just keep tuning. If I form a black hole, I go a little smaller. If I don't, I go a little bit bigger. And so what you see, I don't know how well you'll be able to see it. Yeah. So the yellow and blue, you can just follow. They quickly decide whether they form a black hole or they don't. The others, though, look, they evolve and they evolve. They take a long time to figure out whether they're going to form a black hole. Another thing you might be able to notice is that these ones in here, you can read off the size of the black hole. Look at the magenta. It's going towards one closer to r equals zero than the blue. It's forming a smaller black hole.
Sorry, could you comment a little bit? Well, what's on the axes again?
So this is the radius. Right. So this is coming into the origin, and then it's either going out or forming a black hole. I said it's 2m over r. I think it is, but whatever it is, if it goes to 1, so this is something with the metric. If it goes to 1, it forms a horizon.
Where's 1 at then on this?
1 is at the top.
But it's 2m over r is measured by some distant observer? Or?
Oh, yeah, okay, right. Yeah, so this m is a mass aspect function. So it's basically the just think of this as a metric term. That where the metric is something like 1 minus this quantity. Okay, and so the horizon forms when the metric is singular.
And another just, I guess, technical question is that, so this is, you're coupling the radial perturbations of that scalar field then into the stress energy tensor and then into the metric. Is that right?
Well, sort of. This is fully nonlinear. So these are solutions to the Einstein equations. So I'm not doing anything with coupling. I'm just solving the PDEs.
Well, the matter field is coupling to the
definitely
metric.
Right. Yeah, it's just the right. So I guess in effect it's the radial aspect, right? Because the symmetry prevents the others. Okay, but so there's a lot going on here. And so if I zoom in here,
So one thing you assume is it doesn't squirt around at all. It just stays spherical. Even though it's doing these little oscillations deciding to go to singularity of the coordinate type or blow back out, you don't let it change from spherical shape.
Right.
So it could wiggle a little bit and blow up a different way, become a cigar.
It could
turn into a spaghetti.
That is a very difficult problem. There have been very few numerical attempts at that problem. But that's a whole nother talk. It turns out you still get critical behavior, at least in what's called axisymmetry. So if you only allow sort of an azimuth. The full 3D problem has not been done. Yeah, I mean, I guess I should say that the resolution one needs is incredible. And so this work was done by my advisor, Matt Choptewit. Okay, so this is sort of just leading into what I really want to say, but it was just so neat I felt like I had to mention it. These are those same evolutions. But what I've done is I've transformed this space into log of the radial coordinate. So r equals zero is infinitely far to the left. And this is a bunch of evolutions, and they're doing this oscillation, and they're all doing exactly the same thing. Well, okay, so this isn't all those ones. It's only two. It's the two closest to that critical point. So one forms a black hole, one doesn't. But they take longer and longer in a log time and in log r to do it. And there's this oscillation, there's a period. This is what's called discretely self-similar. So this is a self-similar solution, but it's only self-similar if you look at different scales, at discrete scales. You can think of this as an attracting limit cycle, except for the fact that it's unstable. So it's not attracting, it's one mode unstable. So this is what's called critical behavior. I am not doing it justice. Because I want to get to Adia. So that was in what's called asymptotically flat. In ADS, though, this is a space of constant negative curvature. So Minkowski is no curvature, so it's constant. But this is negative. It turns out that in ADS, if you go out to infinity, you hit the boundary and you bounce back and you come back. And you come back in finite time. So we say that the boundary at infinity is in causal contact with the rest. It forms a box. It's a reflecting box. And so you can look at perturbations of ADS. And some mathematicians conjectured that it's unstable. It's unstable because if you start with a little perturbation, it's got nowhere to go. It can't get out. It can't get away. It's always going to come back. And so some people, Biazon and Rosarowski in 2011, modeled this just sort of like what Chaptuik did in asymptotically flat. And what they find suggests, so they conjecture, that it's going to be unstable to a black hole. Not that if you start with a large amount, you get a black hole, but you start with any amount, it's going to form a black hole. Which was a big deal. A lot of people were interested in this. String theorists, relativity people like me. The reason string theorists are interested is this ADS CFT, right? And I think there's a talk later today about that. Where you have a correspondence between what's called the bulk, ADS, with a conformal quantum field theory on the boundary in one fewer dimensions. So this is holographic. Holography is really pretty cool. I can't cross that boundary. I don't know string theory. I don't know. Yeah, but at least I can say I do some holography. But what's neat is that in a certain limit in the bulk, you can use classical GR. And that's what I do. Okay, so back to the work of Biazon and Rosarowski. They evolved the scalar field. And it always forms a black hole, which seems strange, because if you start with that shell of energy, it comes in, doesn't form a black hole. If it did, they'd just go to some smaller amplitude, epsilon. Doesn't form a black hole. Starts moving out. Asymptotically flat, it would just go off to infinity, never come back. In ADS, though, it hits the boundary. It comes back. Okay, but so what? It comes back. Why is it going to form a black hole? Didn't make sense to me. Their paper is a PRL, so it's short, i.e. not helpful. No, I mean, it was a good paper, it was just, you know, I wanted to know more. Okay. And so when Alex Buchel came to me and said, hey, let's revisit this problem, I said, sure, yeah. I should say, what they did was, what Biazon and Rosarowski did, they did the full nonlinear problem, but they also did a perturbation analysis. And they see this resonance. They see these modes. At linear order, there are these modes. And these modes are basically like a string just oscillating, right? It can fundamental mode, a harmonic, all this stuff. But if you go to one higher order, these modes couple. So if you start with a couple modes, they couple and they source another mode, a higher mode. And then you've got three modes. They source another. And so I picture this string for a couple reasons. But so if you keep going to higher and higher modes, you can think of that as likely going to form a black hole because you've got high frequencies, i.e. you're concentrating energy in smaller regimes. And so they make this picture. Let me explain this picture. So on the vertical here, this is the size of the black hole that they get. And this is the amplitude they start with. So let's start over here. They start with this amplitude, 0.035. They form a black hole pretty quickly. It's a big black hole. So then they decrease epsilon. As they decrease, they form smaller and smaller black holes. At some point, they don't form a black hole. Comes in, doesn't form a black hole. So this is in this regime here. Doesn't form a black hole, goes out. But lo and behold, it comes back and forms a black hole. So as they decrease the amplitude, they get what are called bounces, real technical term, but they bounce and come back and form another black hole. And that critical behavior, I'm not sure I called it that, but the stuff that I showed you at the beginning, the discrete self-similarity, in asymptotically flat, this is the regime we were in, very small black holes. In ADS, though, there's another regime after one bounce, after another bounce, after another, after another. Okay. So the big question is, what happens to the left of this? What happens is epsilon goes really, really small. Extrapolation is easy. It always forms a black hole. But is that right? Numerically, we can't do it. You don't see it on here, but these guys are evolving a very long time here. It's bouncing, I don't know, something like 10 times. Now we're bouncing thousands of times. But numerically, we can never go to epsilon going to infinity. So we don't know. Let me show you this. So in terms of what's going on and why it forms a black hole, it's kind of a long movie here. So I started with some pulse like I did before. It's going out and it bounces back. And then it's going to hit the origin. It's not going to form a black hole. And it's going to go out. What you should keep your eye on is the width of this pulse. It started out really smooth. And you sort of need to look at it at some constant radius. So if you look at it kind of here, it's not very sharp. But with each bounce, it turns out it gets sharper and sharper. So you could think of this as some kind of perturbative way. You can think of it as coupling to higher modes. Or what we've discovered, what we sort of explain it as, is that gravity attracts. And so the pulse is going to self-attract. And so the fact that you can bounce off infinity, you have more and more time for gravity to act, and it sharpens up. So this goes on for a long time. Okay, so we've done this over a bunch of years. So a number of papers here. There are lots of details I'm leaving out. But I'm focusing on this one question. So when we did it, we found what they found. We confirmed what they did, no doubt about it. It was a very good work. But then we started looking at other things. In particular, we looked at what are called boson stars. They don't collapse. And we wanted to know why, so we did some weird things, but eventually that led us to, instead of starting with their initial data, we started with one that was wider. And it did the bouncing for a while, but then it just stopped. So we found some epsilon below which you don't get a black hole, which seemed very strange. If it didn't form after a bounce, you know, that's one thing, but you know, it might bounce 10 times and then no more. And then we could construct solutions that were quasi-periodic, that by design would not collapse. And so this cast some doubt on their work. And so I'm going to leave it at that, except for a couple of things. One thing, let me go back here to this picture. Anyone done this lab in undergraduate? It goes into resonance, right? Well, then what happens? You know, the string's going like this. Well, for some cases, this weight just starts flying up, and it goes out of resonance. You perturb the string so much, it's not in resonance anymore. So that's basically what we found. With the wide Gaussian, what we're, by the time it starts to form a black hole or starts to sharpen up, it's perturbed ADS so much that a special property of ADS has been messed up, and you don't get the black hole anymore. It stops sharpening. Okay. And basically, it's dispersion. At linear order, if you start with some pulse and you don't include any back reaction, this pulse will go off, bounce back. It will be periodic. It will never spread out, never sharpen, never do anything. And that's a property of pure ADS. But so when we talk about this question, there are going to be some regimes where this dispersion wins out and some possibly where it doesn't. It doesn't answer the question, but it explains at least some regions where the answer is no. For other cases, we still see collapse, but we see what are called recurrences. And I've got a nice picture to show you what those are. But so the answer still is not clear. Because to say ADS is unstable, all they need is one example where it continues for epsilon going to zero. So all our work showing lots of cases that don't answer that question. But it sort of frames the question, so you'll have to stay tuned. Okay, because of the talk on the history of physics, I thought I would just dedicate a couple slides to this. How many people know what the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem is? A few, okay. Well, so I didn't know anything. And even if you know the problem, can anyone tell? Oh, the name's on there. Okay. So there's an article in Physics Today that describes this, and I think we need classes on like how women have just not gotten the recognition they deserve. So this is a paper from 55. And so she didn't get her name on the paper. So you might think, oh, she typed the paper. But that's not true. She did a lot. So if you code up the equations, do you get on the paper? I would put someone on the paper if they did that for me. If you ran the code, would you get your name on the paper? I would. So here's a footnote from this paper. First of all, I mean, can you imagine putting this in there? So this paper, I mean, I think it's got some sociological interest. But it's also, this paper is also credited with basically being the start of computational nonlinear dynamics. So it's from 55, so I put the T in there. PRL, I think, removed it from the title of our paper. On the archive, I think it's got the T. The other thing, if you're going to go look at this, she later got married and changed her name, and I think it's something with an M. And I think she got on some paper later. Anyway, so this is not my area of expertise at all, but I thought some of you might be interested a little bit. And this is what I had a high school student work on. And so what this is a bunch of particles connected by springs, and then you make the springs nonlinear. If you take the limit where you have an infinite number of these, you basically recover a system that's very similar to this ADS. And it basically is this vibrating string. But the other reason to talk about this is recurrences. So this is from that paper. This is the energy in different modes. Even though it's a nonlinear problem, you can still look at the energy in each mode. It forms a basis. And so for them, they start with all the energy in mode one. It goes into the high frequencies. So you get this sort of resonance type thing. But what happens later, if you wait long enough, and this is in thousands of cycles, pretty much all the energy comes back to mode one. So we call it a recurrence. This is a plot from our work, where we're plotting the energy in each mode. Just ignore this bottom graph. Ours is slightly different, but we start with energy in two different modes, so the black and the red. And the energy, you can see the high frequency stuff get energy, and then basically it returns to something like what it was at before. And we sort of have an understanding of this. If you made the same kind of plot for what Bizon and Rostorowski originally presented, basically you would cut everything off right about here. You would just get the energy going to high frequencies. Okay. But for some cases, It goes into the high frequencies, it comes back. So again, this is suggestive that maybe this doesn't actually go in the limit that epsilon goes to zero. Okay, but I think I'm done with that. So any questions on that stuff? Okay. Saw you reaching, no? Okay. Okay, so here's a slide that talks about what we're in for in terms of just the level of difficulty. What we were dealing with before was a PDE in one space and one time. This is going to be fully Cartesian, X, Y, Z, T. It's fully dynamic. It's, you know, I don't know that I need to talk about all this. I'm not sure if I'm trying to impress you or intimidate you or what, but there's a lot of stuff that goes into what I'm going to talk about. The stuff I was running before will run on my laptop. It'll run for months in some of those cases if I go to small epsilon. This stuff is pretty intense. I don't, you know, so I think I know one thing I wanted to mention. So the first thing I'm going to talk about basically comes up to here. And the stuff in gray we don't have. But what I'm going to present right now is two black holes with an electromagnetic field. The latter stuff, the stuff Fred cares about, involves this stuff, the fluid, neutron stars. So black holes in this sort of way of looking at things are easy. Before 2005, that was not the case. Okay, and so we had a paper from 55, now we're up to 1977, the Blanford-Sinayak effect. So they weren't doing numerical work. But what they did, they studied a rotating black hole immersed in a magnetic field. Why doesn't the black hole itself have a magnetic field? Because they're looking for stationary solutions. And black holes won't support a magnetic field. They'll radiate it off. So where's this magnetic field come from? You could imagine there's some disk of matter way out here that's producing a magnetic field which is largely vertical in the region of the black hole. These blue lines are the magnetic field lines, and they get rotated up by the ergo region of the black hole. And the orange is the pointing flux. So it's some proxy of electromagnetic radiation. And so this is what they found. And they find that basically the rotational energy of the black hole can escape via this radiation. And they do this all basically with pen and paper. There are a couple details I'm sort of leaving out here. One of which is that this kind of stuff astrophysically is very messy, and this is not messy. This is very simplified. Okay, so it's very easy to argue with this, oh, it's not realistic, that kind of thing. And I'm not here to debate that. What I want is to just present a pretty neat effect, which is albeit very simplifying. Okay, so this was done in 77. What do we need to do? Well, so what we did was we said, well, what happens not with one black hole, but if you have two black holes? What do you get? After we did that, we actually came back to the single black hole, because what we could do numerically, so we could take the black hole and we could adjust the spin. We could just boost the black hole through the magnetic field. We could do lots of stuff. And we did.
Yeah. Just show my inability to follow. How can you have a fixed metric if energy is going away? Fixed doesn't mean static?
The
it's
metric
fixed, but time dependent?
Yeah.
Oh. So is it fixed or solves the semi-toy problem above the line? They did the work in 77.
So they just plug in the Kerr metric.
What?
They just plug in the Kerr metric.
And they don't let the metric change? The energy of the electromagnetic radiation is too small to count?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
It's very small. Okay, I don't have a lot of slides, so I need to kind of build up the tension here before the next line.
Well, at least those lines.
No, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to have two of these black holes moving around. What our initial data is just two black holes immersed in a magnetic field. But we don't start with any of the structure or anything like that. And
are they rotating?
No. I mean, only in the orbital frame.
Orbital,
you know.
Not,
yeah. Okay, and so what we find... Oh, okay, I do have this line. So this is a little diagram that was made. So we've got the two black holes here. This is the circumbinary disk that is producing the magnetic field through which these black holes merge. So astrophysically, what you might expect is two galaxies merge. You get these two supermassive black holes that come together. They clear out this cavity, this region in here. It turns out, so no one's going to argue with me, I guess, but it doesn't get completely cleared out. Again, it's messy. This is simplified. But I still think it's really pretty neat. And here are our evolutions. And again, you're looking at the pointing flux. We've got like the two black holes. So time goes like this and then comes back over here. And then here the black holes have merged. And so if you look at the pointing radiation, I mean, this is sort of what we call like the barber pole kind of picture. And so what we see are basically these two collimated regions of pointing flux, which is something akin to two jets. Right, so let me go back. Here you've got the spin of the black hole powering this pointing flux. Okay, and as Herb mentioned, so there's no spin. There is just the orbital motion. But if you look basically in the frame of a black hole, it's not spinning. It's essentially moving, you know, translating. And so in later work, then we do the boost and everything. And so what we're finding, this is my last slide on that. Oh, okay, well, I'll talk about this in a second. But what we're finding is what I consider a generalized Blanford-Zaniak effect. Blanford-Zaniak was spin gets you this radiation. But you don't need spin, you just need some kind of kinetic energy. You boost it, you orbit, you get this energy. So not only do we relax the symmetry, not only do we find this neat effect with binaries, but we show it's robust, it's stable. It's not some special configuration that as soon as you sort of relax something, it goes away. Okay, so I just wanted to mention something about this graph. This graph is basically the radiation one gets. And here is basically merger time. And we've got the electromagnetic energy as given to us by the pointing flux. And that's on the left side in red. And on the right side, we've got the gravitational wave energy. And both of these are in ergs per second. And they're roughly kind of similar in shape, but not in magnitude. 10 to the 43 for electromagnetic, 10 to the 56 in gravitational wave energy. To me, that's just, you know, that's the LIGO thing, right? But, I mean, and I guess I should comment also, this is not in the band of LIGO. If we have supermassive black holes, LIGO's not going to see this. This thing called LISA, ELISA, whatever they're calling it these days, it doesn't exist. It's always going to be in 10 to 20 years. They may see it.
Run by computers.
Okay, so any questions on this?
Flux. What do you want to just move on? It's okay. I'll ask you at the end.
You mean like this kind of thing? So we
yeah,
talk
like
about sort
umbrella.
Of this there's a sort of an isometric kind of component, and then there's sort of a beamed component. That's all I'd say about that.
That's actually the answer.
Yeah.
I have a quick question. So is the gravitational radiation also beamed in a similar way too?
We didn't look at that. It's not going to be beamed very much, but yeah, it's going to be somewhat beamed. Yeah. Okay. So this is the most recent stuff. This is two neutron stars with what are called realistic equations of state, which is, there's a lot to be said about that. So there's been sort of a progression of equations of state from not very good to reasonably okay to something the astrophysicists will start to pay attention to. They'll still tell us we're wrong and we don't understand stuff, but at least they'll pay some attention. I can't go through all of this. This, I pulled this from another slide, but there is a lot of motivation for this. Right, and this is basically the reason why I get NSF funding. Let me just mention a little bit. So these binary mergers are expected to be the engines of at least some, perhaps most, perhaps all, of short gamma ray bursts. I haven't told you what a gamma ray burst is, so hopefully you guys know what they are, and hopefully you know what the short ones are. Recently, there were one, maybe two of these short gamma ray bursts that, in addition to having a burst in gamma rays, hence the name, they had this afterglow in the, anyone? Infrared band. And this was predicted by people looking at what's called this R-process nucleosynthesis. So this violent merger takes place, this energy gets kicked out. It's very hot, slammed up, shocks. It's hard to believe I'm about to say this, but then these nuclear processes, because I don't know anything about nuclear processes, but these nuclear processes happen, these neutrons get absorbed, and you generate high atomic number elements. Where is it traditionally thought these high atomic number elements come from? Supernovae. But no one's been able to get that to happen. So they're starting to have doubts. Okay. And this is what's called kilonova, macronova, depending on what camp you're in. I'm not in a camp. Again, this LIGO, so the A, you guys know what A LIGO is? Advanced LIGO. When does that come online? Now, it's already, yeah. It's already online. They're not taking science data. And we have leakage, we have magnetic field. I believe I can pat my own back when I say that I think we're the only group who has this going for realistic equation of state and magnetic fields and leakage, neutrino cooling. I'm not going to talk about the magnetic field. So we set out to do some evolutions with our code that can handle this. And we wanted to know what equation of state to use. Because we're just relativists. We go to the experts. So I was actually at the INT a summer or two ago that I, and they're the experts. Well, this person that will go nameless was not, only nameless because he basically said he didn't know which one to use. They don't, there's a whole class of them, and they can rule out some of them, but they're left with some. So one of the big constraints is that someone observed a 2 solar mass neutron star. This is mass of these neutron stars. This is the radius, so a mass radius plot. So this blue line represents what was observed, highest mass observed. So if you have an equation of state that doesn't get you a 2 solar mass neutron star, no one's going to use it. So among that class, we went with the extremes and one in between. The extremes in terms of softness and stiffness. So this blue one, this SFHO, produces the smallest neutron stars for a given mass. So the green line is 1.35 solar masses, which is, sort of the archetypal value that one uses. So if one looks at what radius one gets, with this you get a very small neutron star, with this one you get a very big one, and then there's one in between. Again, that number 3 shows up. Flight of Beers, that's what it's all about. I didn't have a movie ready for you, but I've got these nice color pictures. Anyone care what those things are? Just the four different rows. These are the different equations of state. So this is the smallest neutron stars. This is the biggest. This is basically the neutrino emission, this row here. This one is the electron fraction. Does that mean anything to you guys? That's basically what this material is composed of. So a neutron star is not just a big ball of neutrons. There are electrons. This is important for looking at whether you get a kilonova, because you need neutron-rich material. This is the temperature, and, you know, it's hot. Gets up to something like 40 MeV. The top is the density. I should say this is just a few milliseconds after the merger of these neutron stars. But you can see some differences. Neutrino emission is very different. The electron fraction is different. Temperature, not so much. Density, somewhat similar. We do a lot of analysis, not just make pretty pictures and say it's hot.
What was the second element on? Electrons?
Electron fraction, yeah.
Do you need protons if you have electrons?
We just keep track of the electrons. We assume it's basically
neutral.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew I'd have some question that would just, I'll have to process. This is the LIGO part of the talk. These are the waveforms we get. If you look at this, this is milliseconds. This took 2-3 months for each one on a few hundred processors. But then what we can do is we can combine it with, right, so in this regime, it's basically just the gravitational two-body problem. I know it's dramatic, but I'm not sure it's that dramatic. And so one doesn't need the full apparatus of numerical relativity. One can do what's called post-Newtonian. And what that gets you is you can go back to, you know, I mean, I think we even cut out, you can go back pretty much as far as you want. And you kind of just, it's hybrid because we connect the two. What post-Newtonian can't do is this part. And you'll notice that they're different for the different EOSs. But the question is how different and in what frequency. And so I've got a plot. This is a LIGO-type plot. So this is versus frequency, and this is something like the signal. Right? I mean, H is the signal, what that root F is doing up there. Maybe some people know. It's what the LIGO people want. This curve is basically what LIGO can detect. This is the curve that LIGO can detect if you make it into what's called a broadband configuration, which gets you to higher frequencies. And then on here is our data, the hybrid waveforms Fourier decomposed, so basically it's something like the power spectral density. And one sees that at low frequencies, you get exactly the same thing for the different EOS, meaning the structure of the star just doesn't matter. These are just two-point masses going around. They come closer together, and they go up in frequency. And then the structure of the stars matter. And so you start to see differences. So can LIGO detect this? Maybe. In that configuration. Leakage scheme. So we look at different neutrinos. We look at the neutrino emission. We look at the heavy neutrinos, so the mu and tau neutrinos and their anti-partners. We look at the electron anti-neutrino and the electron neutrino. And we see big differences between the different EOS. And so we've got a couple collaborators that know a lot about these neutrinos, and they can look and see, you know, that basically it's something like 10 kiloparsecs. Super Kamiokande might be able to detect something like 100 to 400 events in 6 milliseconds. So this is relatively close. But the fact that we can say anything about this, I think, is pretty neat. One thing I wanted to mention is that, so I talked about the different EOS, but I didn't quite say why the EOS matters so much. If you have the smaller neutron stars, you might think, well, that's closer to a point mass. So you're going to sort of get less interesting physics. It turns out that what happens is when these things merge, because they're smaller, right? So let's do the big case first. The big case, they just start merging kind of quickly. And it's not a very violent collision. So you don't get a lot of outflow. These small ones fall deeper into the gravitational well. So by the time they hit, they really hit. And they produce a lot of outflow. And so if you're trying to tie it to one of these kilonova, the soft EOS is what you want to look at. Okay. It turns out that there's another compact object binary that one might care about, and that's a black hole in a neutron star. And for a couple different reasons, you get sort of a totally opposite answer, which is interesting because if we see a lot of these, maybe it says, hey, these are binary neutron stars with soft EOS. Or maybe it's saying it's the mixed binary case with the hard EOS. So a lot is still up in the air. Okay, so last slide. Any questions on this? Because the last slide's kind of, yeah.
I'm ignorant. I mean, have there ever been a neutrino burst seen like this? People have seen neutrino bursts? Yeah, okay. I just didn't know. Yeah, was it? Okay, so this is something, I mean, every once in a while we get a blast of neutrinos. That's cool.
And there was reputed gravitational wave detection of that, but
who was that?
Well, Joe Weber.
Oh,
yeah. And we can, whether or not that's why Weber bars are no longer in LIGO, or LIGO beat that, is a sociological question that I know nothing of.
There was the issue of coincident measurements, right, which LIGO not only has within LIGO, but because LIGO and Virgo have an agreement that neither one is going to pre-publish without confirmation from the other. So that when we get the data, there's not going to be this kind of issue that we have with, well, maybe we saw it, maybe not. And with the 1987A neutrinos, it's fair to say also they were seen, but they were only seen because people said you should go look for them, right? It wasn't detected in real time. We saw the supernova, then people said, you know, these proton decay detectors might have seen it. And then what, there were 6 neutrinos in one of the detectors, something like that. So it is, it's different from just sitting around detecting neutrino bursts with the 1987A supernova. Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't entirely retrodiction. I thought that one of the calculations of how many neutrinos they ought to see came out before people had published the data.
That's certainly true. These detectors were not designed as neutrino detectors, is part of the point, right? They were designed to see proton decay. And so, right, so then these calculations were done to say, go look for this. And they went and they looked for it, you know, when 3 hours before the photon detection, you know, the neutrinos came through and the numbers were right. And, you know, everything was astonishing and wonderful. But that's why we have these new generation of neutrino detectors.
They have two different locations. So there would be the coincidence check. They still would not announce until collaborated by this third?
So my understanding from, I've got a colleague who's on LIGO, and I don't know, Nate, if your colleagues talk the same thing, but my understanding is that there's an agreement so you don't get into a situation where you're rushing through your data analysis and you're sure they've seen it too, and you kind of jump the gun before you're really convinced you've done the analysis right. So I think that's the reason, because they have the coincidence, but right, they have their own data analysis protocols and so forth. And I think the concern is that you feel you're in a race, and then you publish something that's bad, and that's not good for anybody. So that's my understanding for how it came about.
Yeah, right, especially for the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Washington doesn't call up Louisiana and say, "We saw it. We're sure you did too."
Yeah. Well, and then VIRGO's right at European collaboration.
Right. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So. Yeah, so, right, if, I mean, obviously, if they don't get the coincidence just within LIGO in the first place, it's different.
They wouldn't, but it's not like Atlas and CMS at the LHC, where, I mean, you have different analysis programs, different detectors, and it was a beautiful example of confirmation.
You're right, so whatever, I mean, they're going to work separately, but the idea is just that they'll say, okay, we think we have a signal to you, you know, same time, et cetera, to... Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
So you also be looking at the same event in the case of LIGO and collaborators.
Unlike detectors at LHC,
right.
They're looking
yeah.
at different events, same effect.
Good point. Okay, sorry for the distraction, Steve.
Anyway, so just the last slide, I figured I'd mention a little bit. I've had some problems with students. So some of the students who aren't mentioned on here kind of started and stopped. And even these who have done some really good work, they, you know, I can't get them all the way to publication. Life events happen, but so anyway, so I'll just close with that.
There's questions?
Yes.
So I will indulge myself in, I guess, looking at the electron density then for the different equations of state. So it does look like each of them have some core in which the electrons aren't there, or is it still a process, the inverse beta decay is still going on?
Let's see. So you're talking about in the stars themselves, or in the region way outside?
I think I'm talking about in the center, and then is it that lower panel that's the neutrinos? Is that right?
This is the neutrino emission. This is the electron fraction.
So is there these shells in which the inverse beta decay is happening? Is going outside in, or?
What do you mean outside in?
Well, I mean, there's a process that you had on that next slide, and this data, or this simulation, maybe it's the leakage scheme,
yeah.
where the neutrinos are being produced. And I guess it's that second charge current beta process. Oh no, that's a positron. Is that a positron?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So charge is not conserved there?
No, the second one should be.
Oh, that's a charge process. Thank you.
No, we should be E minus process.
Yeah, I'm thinking inverse beta decay.
Yeah, that's what the second one should
be. So that should be E minus, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So so your simulation is showing where that's occurring.
Right.
And that's showing that there's this wave of inverse beta decay that's happening as these things are colliding. Is that how I should interpret those plots?
Perhaps. So I haven't looked at those plots in terms of the spatial thing. So, I mean, in general, what we've done is basically make these histograms.
But that's sort of far field, right?
Well, it's the whole field,
yeah.
Right. So I don't, I'd have to look again, and it's kind of hard to see on here. So
I mean, they look at it. Yeah, but if you compare the
electron density and the neutrino flux. Presumably there are protons there. But your simulation also has the proton density in there as well, right?
No, all we keep track of compositionally is the electron fraction.
Is there a reason why the protons are kept track of?
If basically for simplicity, right? So we could keep track of all the...
Right, so it's in your simulation.
Right.
Any further questions?
It's a question about computational astrophysics as a field. And the way that's altered theoretical physics, the use of large data sets, the relationship between the theorists and people at the observatories. Am I asking that specifically enough?
Well, I'm not sure what the question is, but I'm not sure it applies to me because I don't look at data. I just generate this stuff and basically try and characterize it to sort of inform the observational aspects. But I mean, what I tell people is basically I don't look up. We had a GR conference in Australia like 10 years ago. And it was like the last day, and we're out walking around at night, and I said, oh, I should look up. And we're in a group, and we all look up, and we go, and then finally someone was, knew enough about astronomy to start pointing things out. Yeah.
All right, since no one else has a question, I guess I'll follow up. So you mentioned all the pieces of your code. Is that open source code, or is that somewhat open source code?
There you go. Somewhat open source. Yeah, I mean, what we say, when we get asked this, anyone can use it. They would basically need our help to use it. So if they just contact us, then we'd be happy to share.
But the code is on the website.
Some section of the code from some number of years ago is on the
I think we're out of time. Let's thank the speaker again.